Hello, and welcome to Convergently Speaking. Today we have an interview with Samantha McKay about having a better relationship with yourself. It's Dan and Caitlin here. Dan, you had this interview with Samantha. Samantha's somebody that you know from your personality hacker studies, and then you guys have kept in touch. So in this episode, you guys are talking a lot of personality typology and use some kind of technical terminology. Maybe you can give a little bit of a rundown of some of that sort of shorthand and stuff that you guys use.
Yeah, sure. This episode is definitely a bit more technical than most of the other episodes. The main thing that we cover that's probably worth making clear is the shorthand language that we use for the cognitive functions, the Myers-Briggs personality cognitive functions. And it's pretty simple, actually. For example, at one point, I know we talk about TI, and what TI stands for is introverted thinking. And so when you see this in written form, the first letter is always a capital. So the T would be a capital, and then the I is lowercase, which represents introverted. So if you see TI, it means introverted thinking. Whereas if you see capital T with a little e, it means extroverted thinking. And the same goes for feeling, the same goes for intuition, the same goes for all the other cognitive function options. So throughout the interview, we make reference to these shorthand descriptions a few times. So hopefully this clarifies what we're talking about and you're able to follow along. Another thing to point out is that you can also Google these terms. So if you want to learn more about extroverted feeling, for example, you can Google F.E. Myers-Briggs or something like that. And you'll be able to read as long as you want until your heart's content.
Cool. Yeah, so hopefully that clarifies that. You guys reference function stacks as well, which is the four cognitive functions that a person uses. That's also Googleable. I really enjoyed listening to this interview as I was editing it. Samantha has a lot of great insights and life experience. So I hope you enjoy this episode.
This is Samantha that we have today. G'day. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm actually really looking forward to this. It feels like you're one of the people I've wanted to have a solid conversation with. Record one of our solid conversations is what I should say, because we've had plenty.
Yeah, we've had some good ones.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for those listening in, one of the reasons I wanted to bring you on is that for me, I really appreciate the quality and depth of your understanding of typology and personal development systems and stuff in general. And for me as an INFJ, I'm always striving to do that, but I don't always get the real details, the real kind of nuanced, specific info. Just a bit about how we met. I met you through Personality Hackers live event. Oh, what year was that? It was about 2 or 3 years ago now. Three years ago.
2018. Yeah.
2018. And we were both doing the training for the Myers-Briggs profiling stuff. Mm. So yeah, we've known each other a few years, not that long. But tell me something, or tell us something about how you ended up in LA and what drew you there, and maybe just a bit of your backstory.
Yeah, so I ended up in LA because I really wanted to travel. Like, it had been, living in New Zealand for 10 years, visiting family in Australia all the time. You forget what it is to go on a holiday and to do some international travel. And New Zealand's kind of a long way from anywhere. So, when the opportunity came up to go and do that 5-day training, I thought, what a great opportunity to mash it up with some other places I wanted to go and see. And so I went to Seattle and went to the Chihuly Glass and Garden because I just love that glass art. I think it's amazing. And went to the theatre a lot and then came down to LA. Unfortunately, I spent most of LA laying in a bed because I was sick. I got hit with a horrendous cold and was in bed for several days. And then after that, I went to Houston, which was terrible timing because that was Thanksgiving and no one was around. But I did get to go to the Rothko Chapel. And this is an amazing place to sit and process and be with art that really shapes you and talks to you, but also puts you in this meditative space where you can see inside your soul in a way that other chapels just don't necessarily do. I'd wanted to go for a very long time. And so I went several times while I was there, as well as eating a bit of Texan barbecue and going to a few art galleries. But yeah, I really loved that space. So for me, I wanted to meet other people who are interested in typology, to speak type with other people. And I know I learn really well in live environments where I can ask lots of questions. But it was just also this opportunity to tick some things off my bucket list and have some experiences that I've been wanting to have for a really long time.
Yeah. How did you end up drawn to typology? I mean, when we're using the word typology, and I assume, you know, people know what that means, but we're just really referring to, I suppose, personality psychology. Is that how you're using it? Yeah. So Myers-Briggs, Enneagram and other stuff. How'd you end up interested in that space?
Well, that started a long time ago for me. So I remember taking some of my first Myers-Briggs tests 10, 15 years ago or more, and I would always type as an ENTP. And every time I read the reports, I was like, that's not me. I'm not this inventor. I'm not this creator. I'm not this person that they're describing. And I really struggled with that. I really struggled to accept it as a concept, and I couldn't see myself in the reports. And so I then explored all sorts of other typology systems, from DISC and StrengthsFinder to HBDI. Enneagram came a lot later. That wasn't really in the mix in the early days. And I used any or all of them in my work at the time. So after I left the law, I realized the law was not the career path for me. And I started doing a lot of training. And I've been a trainer for 20 years. I had a career that I just didn't know I had. And as I transitioned into working in organizations, in organizational development, being exposed to more of these systems, I would use whichever one felt appropriate for whatever workshop I was running. And DISC was really valuable. StrengthsFinder was really valuable. And using them in all different ways, because I didn't want to get locked into one particular system, so I didn't necessarily get accredited in all of them, but I researched them enough to really understand what is the way to use that for this team or this organization. Then a mutual friend of ours, sent me a podcast that Personality Hacker had done on tribes, because I kept talking to her about wanting to find my tribe. And I think that might be a 90s Sex in the City hangover of, you know, looking for your ultimate girl gang. And I was like, where is my ultimate girl tribe? But when you moved and live in multiple different countries and you're constantly switching around, those relationships are hard to hold on to. But from there, that led me to listening to their ENTP podcast. And the moment that hit home, that it was a model that would really work for me, and that I am an ENTP, was when they were talking about that 10-year-old or tertiary function of extroverted feeling. And when they were talking about it, having real challenges in childhood, trying to please people. And it really reminded me of my challenge when my parents were getting divorced, of trying to keep both of them happy. And that being an impossible task, but as a 10-year-old, you have no idea that's an impossible task. And that was a real struggle for me. And so when I heard that podcast, I knew this was something I needed to know more about. And what I ultimately did and dived into the cognitive function model and into the Jungian model, I think for me, it really hit home that this was a framework that explained how life works, that how everything on this planet run by humans operates and works, because it's all fed through one of those lenses in some form. And it's not just individuals, but also the collective, and how the collective unconscious works in those sort of frames in different ways. And I think that's what I've been looking for my whole life. I'd been looking for a framework. You know, my TI wanted a framework that explained everything. And this
What's
was
TI?
That introverted thinking.
Sorry.
My introverted thinking.
So you talked about your extroverted feeling, which is your third function out of your four, and now you're referencing your second Myers-Briggs cognitive function.
Yes.
Go on.
And I just always been looking for a framework that explained everything. And then I found it. And that then gave me the platform to build up and to focus on something I'd always been interested in and always thought was valuable, but never found a way that truly clicked for me that I could then go, this is something I want to now teach to others or make valuable for other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that ultimately is what led me down this path, because even though I've been using typology in some form for over a decade, it wasn't until I had this model that things really clicked into place for me.
It's really interesting to hear your journey, and it's not just a theoretical journey, but like an actual lived journey using and applying other models. Well, you said you didn't want to just narrow in on one model. And I mean, to what degree have you done that? You obviously do still use other models, but it sounds like Myers-Briggs is something that is a lot more central, or how does...
I'd say it's central, where Enneagram is coming in now. We're weaving Enneagram in now, because I think when we're starting to look at personal development and health, which is an area that I'm really interested in, we have to look at both sides of the coin. I think the Myers-Briggs model and the Enneagram model explain both of those really well. But I think with most people on an everyday basis, they don't need the depth that you and I are interested in it. A 2x2 model, like a DISC model, is almost all they need, because most people just need a single simple insight to shift them in whatever new direction or trajectory they need. And that's fine. And so I will meet people where they're at in their journey and pick a model that's appropriate for them. Now, I have my preferred models, but that doesn't suit everyone at every point in time. And StrengthsFinder is a really fantastic introductory level model for most people. It's a great place to start.
Yeah, I like that. That's really interesting and a bit confronting, your comment that everyone doesn't need the same depth or want the same depth that you or I want and need. And there probably is a need in there, and everyone doesn't need that. That's definitely something that with my counseling clients, I'm very conscious of, you know, the balance between I have heaps of information in my head, which I think is super useful and I really like talking about, versus what is the minimum information and knowledge that's necessary to help this person, you know, at a practical level, because I think you and I both want to genuinely help people, not just, you know, have a bit of, intellectual masturbation is one word for it, but, you know, just like the theory, us intuitives especially can do theory all day, but it's not always helpful.
Yeah.
So with that, I'd love to hear a bit about how these models and these things you've learned blend in or converge into the health stuff. How did you end up getting into the health domain as well?
That's a great question. And my mind is like, where does that begin? Because I think sometimes our life purpose is in some way predestined. And I think I was always meant to end up in the health space, but it takes 40 years of challenges to end up in your specialization. So for me, I grew up with a range of health challenges. I also grew up with a mother who was a nurse. And so I grew up in hospitals and I spent a lot of time with doctors and spent a lot of time being part of the Western medical system. And also having a really strong interest in biology and viruses. And, you know, a lot of the books I read for fun when I was growing up were medical based, were about the body and how the human body operated. So I had a number of health challenges. And in my early 20s, I was put on antibiotics for essentially 6 months because I'd had quite a serious infection. I'd had surgery for the infection. I then on really serious high levels of drugs for like a couple of weeks and then onto low-grade antibiotics that lasted for 6 months. And it was at that time when I moved to Canada, and I was living in Canada for 12, 18 months. And while I was there, I was eating a whole bunch of sugar. Ben and Jerry's was consumed by the bucket load. They had these amazing brownies that came in this packet. And it was incredible. And I totally overdid it, but I was also living in another country. I was grieving the loss of a relationship. You were homesick. You're finishing. There was all, you know, there's all these new experiences. There was so much going on emotionally and physiologically for me. So I started to develop like eczema on my hands, and the patch became quite large over time. And I didn't really know what it was. And so one of the first things I did when I got back to Australia was see a dermatologist. And at this point in time, it was just confined to my hands. And the dermatologist said to me, well, this is for life. This is permanent. So make sure you're not in a career where you have to wash your hands all the time. Here's some steroid creams. Here's the other creams. Use gloves. That's it. Away you go. And for me, that didn't make any logical sense. Something that has just appeared can't be permanent. It's not a sufficient answer. And over time, that led me to try and explore a range of different things, different diets, different healing methodologies. And unfortunately, everything got a lot worse before it got better. And so shortly after that, I was living in London and really hating my job and under enormous stress because of the environment and everything being a struggle on every front. And I essentially then came out in palm-sized welts of weeping sores across my arms and my legs, and that, you know, I couldn't sleep. I had seasonal affectiveness disorder. I was wrapped in bandages. I still had to go to work but wore casual clothes because everything was constantly painful. And it really got to the point where I basically had to go to the emergency department and be put on a seriously high, large dose of steroids in order to start the reset process. And it was so high, I wasn't allowed to take any steroids for several years after that. And so I'd gone through all of this and I could see how much was stress related and diet related and damp environment, English countryside, London related. Yeah. What I hadn't factored in and what I didn't know until years and years later was that the antibiotics really affect your gut. And once you've had antibiotics at any for any duration, you basically need to stop eating like gluten for at least 6 months after you've had the antibiotics because your gut is so destabilized. And I didn't know that at the time. And here I was happily consuming, you know, my brownies and bagels like there was no tomorrow. And so all this was going on and all of me is falling apart on every front. Then we hit the crunch point. And the crunch point, I was standing in the office one day and I was still a lawyer at this point. And I was looking at a case I was running. I was a litigation lawyer. And this case had six folders. It was going to court shortly. Nothing particularly dramatic. But I looked at these folders and I saw that something had fundamentally changed within my brain. Because just a year earlier, I'd been running a case in Sydney, multi-million dollar case, and I had 18 case files to go to court. And I had a photographic memory. I could tell you where every single document we needed was in the folders and find it within a minute. So not photographic memory to the extreme that some people are, but enough that I know where everything was. And I looked at these folders a year later in London and I had absolutely no idea what was in them. Mm. And that was the moment, because we are very good as humans at ignoring our health until it takes away the one thing we value the most. And for me, particularly as an ENTP, the one thing I value the most was my brain and my eyes.
Mm.
And once I lost my memory, I was like, there is no going back. This is now the turning point for which my life now must shift, because this is not satisfactory. And when you have such high levels of cortisol for such a prolonged period of time, it can affect the brain. It can affect how the brain functions. And you weave in a whole lot of that, not a lot of sleep. You know, there's so many things that affect the brain function, but that loss of memory, and it hasn't truly returned. One of the things I had to learn to live with the 10 years since then is to not have that level of memory. And so one of the pros of that, because for every con there is a pro, is I've learned to trust my intuition a lot more and live a lot more instinctually intuitive. But that took a long time. I really had to go through this acceptance and grieving process that I had lost my brain capacity and function in a way that most TI or introverted thinking users couldn't comprehend, because all that, what we talk about, that ability to visualize and random access and move things around inside your mind, all of that was gone. I could no longer see my mind working. So I fell apart, changed careers, moved to New Zealand, not through my own choice, but arrived in New Zealand realizing this is a place without many distractions, which as an Enneagram 7 and an extroverted intuitive user, we love distractions. I love to fill my days with things that excited and brought me joy. But New Zealand, there just wasn't so many of those. And I knew I needed to stay here, no matter how hard it was, because this was the place I was going to be able to do the healing I needed, because it was, there was no choice. There was nothing exciting to do. I had to do the work on fixing myself. And it's been great because there's been some very great healers here, some great alternative practitioners that have really helped me get back to a place where I function so much better than I did, you know, even just a few years ago. And because I've gone through that journey of having severe chronic illnesses of multiple kinds, having the capacity to look at it from different angles and to have the finances to access different modalities and therapies, I've just done so much work on realizing that health is not just physical. Chronic health issues are emotional, they're mental, they're spiritual, they're on every level. And really address chronic health issues, you sort of have to look very holistically. You know, we talk about, you know, integrative health practices, and often that's still thinking just within the physical being. Let's not just think about the heart or the liver. Let's think about how all those organs and those physical systems interact. But that doesn't account for how the organs of the emotional body, which are all intangible and chemical and hormonal, how do they interact? And how does the way we think about things and the chemicals produced from our thought systems and how that impacts on our fight or flight system, how does that impact? And our spiritual connections with ourselves, with other people, our purpose, if that's lacking, how is that impacting? And how does that show up in our physical being? And that really is a true view of our holistic health. And very few people really talk about or explore that. And so it's been quite a journey to work through each of those spaces to get back to a place of health.
Wow, what a story. I could tell a very similar story with slightly different, factual pieces, but a very similar trajectory of having now in my late 30s, better health than I did in my late 20s really all of my 20s. And it's interesting you talk about the antibiotics, because I also have concluded that frequent and large doses of antibiotics are probably one of the major, major contributors to cascading negative health effects. You know, there was stuff going on before, but I think that was a lot of that was the tipping point. And maybe I'll talk about that at some point on the podcast, but not today. But yeah, it's really cool to hear that background and, you know, how you've ended up passionate about the things you're doing now and engaged and, I don't know what the word is, fulfilled or focused in a way that it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, sounds like you weren't before, you weren't as a lawyer. What stuff are you doing? Like, we're talking around it, but like, what are you doing now and where have you ended up? And obviously you trained in the personality hacker model like I did. But what else is going on?
Well, before then, I trained as a trainer and a facilitator. That was something I've been doing since the beginning of my career. But along the way, I became an accredited coach, and that was a huge shift for me, you know, particularly as like ENTPs, that introverted thinking side doesn't listen very well. It's, you know, give it three bullet points and it's off on another planet. And it really trained me in my listening skills in a way I hadn't before, but also in my emotional intelligence. I am someone who is both highly sensitive to emotions of other people and myself, but also lack emotional intelligence in other ways. And it's a real challenging paradox to navigate. And I was in the first day of my coach training, and everything about coach training is always labeling of emotions. And I had no vocabulary for emotions whatsoever. And I think I must have been the only person ever to walk up to this trainer and go, do you have a list of these emotions we're talking about? Because I have no clue what they are. No clue whatsoever.
And there is a beautiful big list that you can get. I saw it when I was studying counselling.
That's right. And she was like, oh, you'll find that on the internet. I'm like, but I need it now. I need it today. And that really set me on a new journey around skills I needed but didn't have.
Mm.
And so, yes, we had the coach training and becoming a coach and working on that phase, and then the profiler training got woven in there as well, and a few other bits and pieces along the way. I did some healing training to explore what it was like to be an energy healer, and I did I can't remember now. You know, there's multiple other things I would have got excited about and explored along the way.
You've also read a lot of books. I know that.
I have read a lot of books. I read 100 books. No, no, that's a lie. I read 98 books last year.
Yeah.
Up from, I think, 86 the year before. I was trying to read less, but, you know, the pandemic kind of got in the way. Yeah.
So at least for the rest of us that struggle to read 10, we know that you don't have a photographic memory anymore, so it, it balances out.
I think one of the challenges, though, when one of your compulsions to relax is reading, you're not always taking it in. So I can read very quickly, but I can have low comprehension.
Yeah.
And there is times when I really need to learn to slow down and really take things in. And I've really started working on the practice of reading books twice. You know, as someone who loves newness and novelty, the thought of watching a movie a second time or reading a book a second time was really outside of my paradigm. But I have my favorite book, and I've read it like three times now. And each time I read it, I get something more from it. And so now I need to start doing that with other books.
So what's your favorite book?
Oh, that book is The Court of Wings and Ruin by Sarah J. Maas. It's fiction. Okay. But I didn't realize it at the time. I only realized it in a review later, and then when I read it the second time. It's actually a book about a person processing PTSD and recovering from PTSD. And it's written in such a way that it's not ever particularly said, but that is what is happening in that journey. So the first book in the series is going through the process of the trauma, essentially, in a fantasy realm. And then the second book is how does she heal and come out of that and that process she goes through. I really enjoy that book. The other book I do want to reread is a book about anxiety by Sarah Wilson, who the I Quit Sugar person.
Oh, yeah.
And the book's called First We Make the Beast Beautiful. And it's just, I love the way she writes. And it's an excellent exploration around anxiety and our mental health. And it's very beautifully written, which I love. So, but yeah, your question about what am I doing at the moment? So at the moment, I'm in the process of pulling together some of the processes that I have used on my healing journey, ones that I've almost invented from a combination of different practices that I've pulled in, you know, from different things I've explored, and working to make them available for other people. So my company, Individuo, will shortly have these things available. I say shortly because it seems to take a lot longer. And I think that's a really important thing. When you have chronic illnesses, you need to give yourself permission for things to take time. I had a migraine yesterday. I spent the day in bed. I was grieving today. I spent the day in bed. And yes, that slows down my process, but I also need to acknowledge this is part of my experience and I need to honor that and give myself permission for those things. And so even though in 2 months' time I'll be frustrated that it's taking so long, I have to remember that it's a journey, you know, and it doesn't happen as quickly as it might for other people.
That's right. And I think when you're wanting to operate, and this is for me as well, you know, when someone's wanting to operate in a healing space, in a development space, then forcing yourself to hustle is kind of counter to the very mission of what you're trying to live and embody and preach. And so running yourself into the ground to create, in your case, you know, some resources around healing, it's counter to the actual goal. And I've had to wrestle with that too, you know. I want to achieve big things which help people be well and healthy and thrive. then I have an impulse to push myself. And, you know, it's this kind of weird paradox. But I think the beauty in it is that when we live within balance, you know, as much as is possible, we end up learning lessons from living what we're preaching that end up being able to become what we preach later on, you know, like your story and your lived experiences, as much as you probably feel like you've wasted time and money and energy, at least the way I reframe it, because I need to, you know, to not feel like I've wasted all this, you know, you go, oh, I actually was like creating my mission, creating my destiny. I was discovering what I'm here to do and what's going to give meaning. So if you're able to help someone with their skin issues because of yours, then it sort of redeems it all. But before we started, we were saying, well, what should we talk about? And one thing we were thinking of focusing on a little bit was this idea of having a better relationship with yourself, which seems to be a lot of what all your projects are converging in on. Tell us a bit about that. You were saying, yeah, beforehand, that the sensor intuitive split or difference from a Myers-Briggs perspective, and people that listen to this podcast have some understanding of what a sensor versus an intuitive is, and how that actually plays into our relationship with ourselves.
So one of the things I've learned through this journey is with chronic illnesses, we are part of the problem. You know, what got us here today won't get us back to health. And I think that's really challenging for people because there's that balance between blame and responsibility. So I take responsibility for being where I am today, but I don't blame myself for all the choices I've made because part of that is unconscious habitual behaviors.
Yes.
But if some people hear this, they would read that as, well, this is your problem. You've done this to yourself. And that's not really what this is about. This is acknowledging that we operate on habitual behaviors that lead us into certain things. And our personality can help describe some of the habitual behaviors that we follow. And I think without attributing fault, you know, because INFJs will have certain health issues or health sort of cul-de-sacs that they get stuck into, and ENTPs will have certain health cul-de-sacs they get stuck into. And by understanding elements of your personality, you can use it to leave the hole, to walk back out the road and make a different choice. So it's not about thinking I'm at fault. It's about thinking, how can I use my own knowledge to be empowered to make a different choice? And I think that's one of the challenges, because who is the expert of you? Like, who knows your body better than anyone? Like, is it your doctor? Is your doctor the expert of you? Or is it you? Who has spent the most time with your body in your life? Who has lived in your body more than anyone else? You. Like, no one else has lived inside of you. I'm sure you've wished they had at times. But, you know, so we are the experts of our bodies and our lived experiences. But when we don't think about ourselves as our own experts, we think of other people as experts, we then stop listening to the signals that our body sends us. We don't listen to the information that we're getting, because our body's communicating with us all the time. And not just, you know, the basic stuff like, am I hungry? Do I need to go to the bathroom? Do I need to sleep? But it's communicating to us about, well, I'm in pain. Well, that pain is for a reason, you know? Or you've overdone it physically. Maybe it's time to rest. Or you're breaking out in eczema. Well, maybe that's because you've got prolonged anger at someone that you haven't expressed yet. Or you're really sad and depressed. Well, maybe that's because you're in a job that isn't in alignment with who you are. Maybe it doesn't support you. And that in turn might lead to other physical health issues. So one of the things in the way I use personality to help us understand a relationship with our body is those sensing functions. Because sensing intuiting is about how we learn and how we take in information. And when our starting point about our health is our physical body, well, then we're starting with the sensory aspects of those learning styles. So introverted sensing or extroverted sensing. And whichever one it is for you, you're going to have a preference about the information from your body that you trust. And so someone with introverted sensing is going to have more skill or nuance or awareness around the signals coming from their internal body, or it's called interoception, learning from the internal body. And that can be things like how the lungs are working, how fast your heart is beating, do you have stomach cramps, what are the kidneys doing, how do your muscles feel? So it's all sort of internal, like organs and functioning. Whereas for external sensing or exteroception, you're more aware of what's happening on the external body. So how does the skin feel? How are you responding to this environment? How do things smell? How do things taste? Is my balance off? Do I feel like I can stand up? Can I jump off of things? It's more externally orientated. And so then when it comes to health, what I've noticed when we're talking about people who lead with external sensing, that they're really disconnected from the internal signals from their body, and they don't feel like they have as much of an expertise or an understanding of those internal signals. But they're very attuned to, does this taste good? Does this smell bad? And responding to food, using food just as an example, in that way. Whereas people with a strength in the interoception or introverted sensing can really tell when their gut is out of whack, when their stomach is unhappy, and can be really attuned. And I've spent a lot of times with eights and nines, just throw in some Enneagram here. And I'm curious as a one whether you've got this as well, but they're really attuned to their gut and how it's functioning. And they spend a lot of time sitting on the toilet.
Yep, gut issues because, well, gut focus. Yeah. And often that would be issues for the gut types, which is, for those listening along, is ones, nines and eights. Yeah. And they talk about with the gut types that, when I've heard it explained to try and understand what it's all about, they experience life as this very full assault, like visceral body gut assault thing. Like everything's quite full on. Ones, eights and nines all experience that differently. But yes, I relate to that. And yes, a lot of my health issues have... and that's physical and emotional health issues have revolved around my gut. So I'm tracking with you.
I think what I've noticed with the eights and nines is that because they don't experience emotions as emotions, they experience them as a physical energy or a physical sensation, that if they're not processed or they don't know how to deal with them and they're not flowing out of them naturally, that they then get gut issues, which they interpret as a physical problem, rather than going, oh, I have some unprocessed emotions that need attending to. And when we live in a paradigm that says every physical sensation is a physical health issue, we can really miss that step that sometimes it's just an emotional or a mental cause. And by mental, I mean our thought patterns.
And it might be a chicken or the egg. So it starts with mental or emotional, and then it does become a physical thing, and that just plays into thinking that everything's physical.
Yeah, and it bounces around. Yeah, because we're a constant, complex, moving system, you know, it's always acting and responding. We're never static.
So going back to what you were saying about sensing and extroverted sensing and introverted sensing, I'm assuming that the way... the positioning of that particular sensing function, and we all have a sensing function, one of our four functions is a sensing one, really, really impacts. So the person with introverted sensing as their first function would obviously have a much more sophisticated ability to, it's not introspect, what was the word you used?
Interoception.
Interception. I do know the word, but it's not saying that they have better interception than, for example, someone who had introverted sensing fourth, which would be you, actually, wouldn't it?
Yes, that is me.
So how does that, tell us more about how that all plays out with the positioning of the sensing function.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And I should comment that I also have sensing fourth.
Yes.
But I have extroverted sensing fourth and you have introverted sensing fourth.
Yeah, so just focusing on introverted sensing because I'm more familiar with that. Is I spent a lot of time with an ESFJ. So they have introverted sensing in their second position. And one thing I found really astounding was the level of comfort and understanding and recognition of what was happening in their body. And the ability for me to explain what was happening in my body and then for them to tell me how to adjust my body to remove that pain. Wow. So we used to go running together and I would love to be a fantastic runner, but that's still a work in progress. Because of my various, you know, physical issues and chronic health, we'd get a lot of pain. And because he was quite used to feeling how his body responded, he'd be like, okay, you just have to lift that knee just a little or just twist this. And it would really change. He would notice things about the way my body was moving and be able to link it to what I was saying from a internal pain perspective. And we could make these adjustments that I was just clueless about. And I really found it fascinating to observe someone who had that real strength in being able to sense and understand their internal system really strongly.
So what you're telling me is I should be going to my wife rather than paying all these expensive practitioners because she's got introverted sensing first.
Potentially. I mean, what's your observation of Caitlin and how she interacts with her body?
What you're covering here is quite new to
okay.
me.
Okay.
My understanding of introverted sensing, and I have one, yeah, I haven't thought about it in this way before. So I can't give you a real-time answer other than she is generally, is more organically, has a more natural, healthy relationship with her body in ways that I have to work at. Mm. I've observed that much. But, yeah, I'm going to ask her about that now.
Well, one of the more traditional definitions of introverted sensing is that we learn from the past, we learn from our memories. And so if we just layer that in for a minute, we often assume that that means that all our memories are stored in our head brain, but actually those memories are stored throughout our body.
Mm.
They're stored within every organ, within our heart brain, within our gut brain, within our muscles. And one of the things that introverted sensing people are good at is being able to go into their body to collect those memories from wherever they're located. Because they're more comfortable with their body, accessing those memories in the past is easier because they're just trained to interocept from wherever it is within them, not just within the head brain.
Yeah. Can you expand for us what you mean by the different brains?
Yeah. So I've talked about that. Yeah. So the research shows that we have three brains. And if you want to look more into this, it's the M-Braining book is the place to start, that we have enough neural connections within the heart and the gut for them to operate independently. And so what that really means is that the heart and the gut, separately from the head brain, can take information in, they can learn, and they can make decisions for you separate to your head brain. So they don't need the head brain to be part of that process. And one of the moments where it really stuck out to me that my gut brain had a lot to say in what I got to do and not to do was one day it was after work and I was walking down the pavement towards a friend's car to do something I sort of wanted to do, but I sort of also knew that I probably shouldn't do and could have been a little bit dangerous and inappropriate, as sevens are often want to get themselves into.
Yeah.
And I took one step forward and my legs froze. My legs froze on the pavement and I could not take another step forward. And my top half of my body flung forward like a rag doll. And I knew exactly what was happening. So I burst out in hysterical laughter because I knew my body was saying, you're not doing this. This is not appropriate. But that wasn't my head brain or my heart brain. That was my gut brain going, no, we will not allow this to happen. And all I could do was walk around, turn the other way, walk away and, you know, go home and be sensible. And so I think we forget that these brains have a lot of stored memories, a lot of stored decisions from the past about how to keep us safe, about how we want to behave, that have stored from childhood, you know, decisions we made in childhood that we weren't fully conscious of. And they still play a role in our lives today. And one way I notice this as someone who has interception and introverted sensing a lot lower is that often when I exercise, random emotions will come up that seem not connected to anything. So I might be doing some yoga and I burst out into tears and I cry for a solid 10 minutes. One time I was in the gym on one of those mountain climbing machines and I got so angry, I had to leave the gym and come home and scream into a pillow because I didn't know what this anger was about, but it had to be released in some form. And so for me, those memories don't come up in a conscious way, but when I'm using parts of my body that have those stored, things do emerge that I have to figure out how to release, even if it's not a clear memory attached to it.
And how have you seen, and maybe I'm stretching your knowledge, but how have you seen this same sort of dynamic at work with extroverted sensing?
Yeah, great question. And I don't have as much experience with extroverted sensing, although I have a very extroverted sensing dominant family that is somewhat clouded by our family having challenges around food and eating disorders. And so that clouds things a little bit in the way those show up. And so I have family members who struggle to get into action and struggle to take forward motion and eat things that they probably know they shouldn't. But that is a universal experience that anyone of any personality type can do for different reasons.
Yes.
And yeah, I've also met ENFJs whose health problems are related to having hip replacements, and they're really comfortable walking every day and have a really balanced relationship with food. And so it's just different. And I haven't fully wrapped my head around it yet, only to say that because there's less awareness of the internal system, they may go longer without attending to some of those physical issues. So as someone with introverted sensing lower, my signals from my body might feel like hypochondria because I don't know how to interpret them. Mm. And so it's something I've just had to learn over time. Is this real? Is this like, what is this? Whereas because extroverted sensing isn't tuned into that, it may take something like a heart attack or a really big physical illness to notice that something is wrong within the body. Now, I don't know if that's true or not.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to share a little bit about extroverted sensing for me.
Okay.
And that will give your extroverted intuition an opportunity to think, because I suspect that information's in you. I don't know which part of your body, but it's in there. And so, you know, for me as an INFJ, and I haven't probably talked a lot about INFJ specifically on the podcast, because there's plenty of INFJs on the internet doing that. But for me as an INFJ, the most profound piece of learning in a really practical way for my daily life hasn't actually been learning that my second function is one that I tend to, by default, want to avoid, which is the main thing that personality hacker teach. That's been profound, but it's really understanding extroverted sensing in the fourth position and what role it plays in my life, and kind of who this little three-year-old kid or toddler extroverted sensing is, and what their role. Basically, I was blind to its existence for a long time. And I think the classic example that comes up for me in my mind when I think about extroverted sensing, how it's played a role in my life, to your point about big dramatic things waking you up to your body and to your internal body, I can cast my mind back to trips I took overseas where I had really long plane flights. And way back then, I could just sit down in a plane and basically go, well, I'm on a plane now and I've got to be here for many, many hours. And I was just not at all connected to my physical body. It's like I'm just a head sitting on this body. And there was like, it's almost like I disconnected the wiring from the head to the body and I just sat there. Mm. And I actually slept. I would actually sleep and could sleep pretty much all through flights. But yeah, over time, I ended up with a lot of back problems and a lot of other issues, health issues. And at some point, it's like a switch was flicked and I started to become aware. It's like, oh, there's a body. And but I did not know how to process the data. So, you know, nowadays if I go sit on a plane, now obviously I'm older as well, but it's not as easy for me to sit on a plane. I'm more aware of the lack of fresh air. I'm more aware of the lack of sunlight. I'm more aware of the lack of movement and the fact that if I eat the crappy food, my body doesn't feel so good. And that if I'm sitting there and I get free alcohol and I add that into the mix, it's only going to make things worse. And so in a weird paradoxical way, I quote unquote cope worse with a long plane flight than I once did in the past. And so for me, it's been about waking up to my body, but I still struggle to comprehend and interpret the data that I'm now becoming aware of in a way that it sounds like your friend who has introverted sensing second wouldn't struggle. So I may be aware that running, I have a sore knee, and sort of be more focused on that than I would have in the past, where honestly, when I was a lot younger, I would have just ignored the sore knee. It was not on my radar.
Hmm.
Or maybe the point that I noticed it would be much more extreme. But I don't know what to do with the information. I definitely don't go, well, yeah, if I move in this way, my knee will hurt less and so on and so forth.
Mm.
So I could say more about the role it's played, but maybe I'll throw it back to you. I don't know if that triggers any thoughts in your mind.
I was thinking about plane flights and how I used to also be able to sit on plane flights for hours and never need to really get out of my seat. And of course, I'm older and we now take up more space in the seat than we used to. But for now, me, it's now the consciousness I need to go to the bathroom more often. That's what I've become more aware of. I can't hold off and ignore the needs of my internal body as much.
Yeah.
And that's been the shift for me on that front.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm exactly the same. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, those were the days. I could sit 12-hour flights and it'd be fine.
Oh, yeah. You just don't get up and you go into watching back then, you know, before like phones and all that, it was like you watch whatever's on the screen and you disconnect.
I think the thing about introverted sensing in a higher position, or even maybe extroverted sensing in a higher position, and I think I'm still thinking about these body types, is that they hear those signals and they will do the normal thing with them. They won't necessarily go, oh, this is some sort of health issue I need to do something different with. You know, they're better at reading the signals but not necessarily doing anything with them.
Yes.
The thing that really shocks me about chronic illness and our human ability to ignore our problems is that the average period of chronic illness for men is 16 years and for women is 19 years. And for me, that reigns true. I have been chronically ill in some form for almost 20 years, if not longer, if you go back to thinking about teenage stuff, 25 years, if we go back to teenage years. And it really astounds me that as humans, we can be unwell or chronically unwell for that long. And a lot of that has to do with our ability to interpret the messages we're getting, to know what to do with them. And if we do take action to get support from someone who will listen to us, even if we don't fully know what we're talking about.
Mm.
And to be able to deal with those symptoms where they're still young. And I don't mean that in age, but we often live in a system that only acknowledges a chronic illness when it's very severe.
Mm.
You know, a lot of the mild ones are sometimes, oh, we'll just wait and see, you know? Whereas sometimes
they don't have names for them either. So I experienced a few things that we were testing levels of certain things, like looking at the adrenal glands and all that. And within the mainstream framework, there's, I think it's Addison's disease. That's the disease that if there's a problem with the adrenal glands and cortisol levels and all that, that's the disease they look for and test for. So like if you're not at that level of dysfunction, then it doesn't actually register on any framework within that paradigm. Whereas I had adrenal fatigue where my adrenals were fatigued from pushing out too much cortisol and other hormones for too long. But I had to, like yourself, go into a more like see more alternative practitioners that had more nuanced ways of measuring these things.
Mm.
And it was dramatic, really dramatic. Whilst I didn't have Addison's disease, there was definitely big life-altering issues at work that needed treatment. And,
yeah.
You know, what my biggest learning was to get diagnosis before starting to try and fix things, because after a while you're just taking pot shots.
Yes. And the sicker you get, the more pot shots you're willing to take, because the more desperate you are, because the more pain you're in. And you do get to that point. And I think everyone with a chronic illness gets to the point where they're willing to try anything. But having a diagnosis is really useful, and you can get a diagnosis. You just have to keep persisting to find the right person who can give it to you. There's a practitioner here I currently see for emotion code work, which is using kinesiology and muscle testing to understand trapped emotions that are causing you pain and to remove them from the body. But as originally I was seeing her as a nutritionist to try and figure out, why is food causing me so many problems? And I went to see her a few times, but the foods that were coming up that I shouldn't eat, there was no consistent pattern to them. I was doesn't make any sense. There's no logicness to the answers my body is giving you. And so then that led me to try a different naturopath that someone had recommended. And this naturopath was excellent at finding a diagnosis. And she had tools that a lot of naturopaths don't use. And so she diagnosed, you know, adrenal fatigue. And then we worked through a range, you know, of diets. So I was on the autoimmune paleo diet for a while. We tried the SIBO diet for a while, ultimately, you know, on the FODMAPs. Because as each time we did a bunch of healing, my gut changed and we had to respond to those changes. But yeah, having someone say, oh, actually, you've got adrenal fatigue in amongst a whole range of other things was fantastic, you know? Mm.
So now we've ended up on adrenal fatigue.
Ugh.
One of the game changers for me, and we don't need to go heaps into it, but I want to say this because one of the game changers for me was salty water.
Okay.
Because when you have adrenal fatigue, you deplete your body of a lot of minerals. And having water with a little bit of salt in it was just like the tastiest drink I've ever had. My body was just like, oh, my goodness. And, you know, if about 3 days into drinking that, and I'm not talking lots of salt, but, you know, just like a bit.
Yeah.
Within about 3 days, I noticed an improvement in my energy and just general well-being. Because you dehydrate yourself when you're running on cortisol and adrenaline for so long. So,
yeah, I don't remember having the salty water, but I had a lot of bone broth.
Yep.
And I spent a lot of time, it was a solid 12 months where all I did was make bone broth and drink bone broth. And it was fundamental. It was game changing in terms of that internal healing, but also it would have provided a range of salts and fats and things.
Mm.
And yeah, that was really, really useful for me.
Yeah, I think it fulfills a similar role.
Mm.
So what you haven't mentioned yet, and we don't need to, we can't yet go into lots of details, but you are creating something which is a comprehensive tool for helping. Tell us a little bit about it, even if it's just like a teaser almost.
Sure. So I'm creating what I'm calling a sort of a health mapping process, and it's to help you really read and listen to like the signals that your body is sending you. Because one of the things I did was I created a timeline of every illness I've ever had. And I realized when I was doing this timeline that actually that went back a long time. You know, I had chronic strep throat infections through my teenage years, and I was taking antibiotics for all the skin breakouts I was getting. Chronic illnesses went back a really long way. And then I mapped out, like you might do, and this is where I got this from, a design thinking process. Well, what was going on at that time? You know, what was happening in my life at those times? And then I layered in each of those four elements of the body. What was happening in the physical body? What was happening in the emotional body? What was happening in the mental body? What was happening in the spiritual body? And really looking at, you know, what was I thinking at the time? What was I feeling at the time? What were my needs at the time? And were those needs being met? And I've created a process that allows you to do this in a really easy way, to go back through your life, list out all the illnesses you've ever had, all the diagnoses you've gotten, all the treatments you got, but then going that extra layer deeper. What were you feeling? What was going on? What did you need? And what you then do is you're able to then look back over your entire health history from your own internal insight perspective, your expertise, your knowledge of you, and go, what's my body been trying to tell me my entire life? What has these illnesses been trying to convey to me? What am I not seeing about myself? It's a way to hold up a mirror to your own health experience, but to a deeper health experience. And what that process then allows you to do is to be more strategic about where you invest your money for treatment. And so a friend of mine has done this process, and she'd been trying to just get treated for anxiety. And when she went through the help mapping process, she realized actually she had PTSD, and she needed to take an entirely different approach and see a very different kind of therapist or treatment. And it's been a huge fundamental shift for her. It's made a huge difference in her life because she was treating the wrong problem, or treating the problem in a way that wasn't effective for her. Because I have spent a lot of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars on my health over the past 10, 15 years. And it's not a luxury that everyone has. And so I want to make it possible for people to get the insight that their body has just waiting for them there underneath the surface, so they can invest their money and their time and their energy in the treatments that will be most effective for them. And I can't tell anyone what those treatments are. Only that's something you can know from yourself and your own persistence in finding the right practitioner.
Yeah. So I realized that what really helped me a lot, and I was learning Myers-Briggs, I was just starting at the time that I was really unwell. I had a period where I had fatigue to the extent that I was basically bedridden for 3 months, not quite, but very close to fully bedridden. You know, that was kind of like the dip. I was unwell before and I was unwell after, but that was the peak of it all. And what I realized was, because I, you know, for all intents and purposes, I'm better. You know, I'm healed, I'm recovered. And although I'm aware that having introverted thinking third in my personality means that it's not my biggest skill, I could tell that there was something about me and how I was going about things that was enormously helpful. I had a friend at the time who was very sick before I got sick, and remains, as far as I'm aware, remains sick to this day. And so I realized the point I'm trying to make is I realized that my intuition in my personality was actually a gift and a blessing, because I was prepared to firstly take a few leaps. I didn't need a scientific paper for every idea I was exposed to. So take a few leaps, but also see a big picture of what was going on. And what I hear you saying is you're essentially creating a product and a process, which is, it's almost like being able to gift others your intuition, your intuitive skill. And what you have that I don't have is you do have introverted thinking stronger than I do. So whilst I was able to do it for myself, I think I'd struggle to formalize that and make it into a linear process, which I struggle with. That's really exciting. Because yeah. I always thought, oh, these poor people that don't have intuition, doesn't mean to say they don't have other skills that can help them get better, but I find some of them that need to have a stronger need to outsource to others, to trust the experts. It just doesn't work because, as you say, we need to be our own experts. Well, we are our own experts, and we need to realize, you know, we know ourselves better than any practitioner ever could.
Yeah, I had an ESTJ friend, and I say had because the friendship has unfortunately gone its separate ways, but I had an ESTJ friend with chronic illness and multiple surgeries and things just spiraling out of control and ending up in a very ungreat place. And she almost couldn't move forward without someone explaining to her what was going on in her body. The problem was that it's not explainable from a pure physical Western medical system.
Yeah.
Because it was all multidimensional, and, you know, there would be stress related and a bunch of other things. And that 10-year-old function of extroverted intuiting was like, I need to know. I need someone to tell me. I can't move on until I get the big picture, until I get the full answer that explains everything. And the problem is, when you get stuck in a chronic illness, is there is no one answer. It is a complex system at play which you just have to start unraveling piece by piece.
I had a few people ask me, did you ever work out what was wrong with you? And I'd just look at them and I'd say, yeah, five things.
Oh, I remember once the emotion code woman recommended this letter writing system. She's like, write down everything about your skin that's a problem, write down when you get angry and sad, and or list out all your previous relationships and write a letter, this three-letter process to every them. And I went home to my sister's house for Christmas and I basically just wrote for 3 weeks straight. And it was the most cathartic process and brought up emotions that I just hadn't considered for a while and a lot of relationships that had never been fully grieved. And that's really when I knew that emotions and unexpressed emotions were playing a huge role in what was going on for me.
Yeah. Tell us something about grief. I know that was the other topic that you mentioned. You've been thinking a lot about, but also doing a lot of grieving.
Yeah. So I'm developing a program around grief. It's called Processing Everyday Grief because we have a lot of grief in society that we don't really acknowledge or allow ourselves to grieve, such as the loss of relationships, the loss of a job, moving house, moving country, things that are not related to a specific form of death, but rather that are just change, because our lives are changing all the time and each of those changes needs some form of grieving or ending process because it does bring up those feelings that we often have no idea how to deal with. And grief is not a simple emotion. It's often intertwined with other emotions, which makes it complex and hard to deal with, which means we try and shelve it and it doesn't go anywhere. It just stacks up until we get another grief. But the reason grief has become important to me is not just because I've experienced a lot of loss in this past year with the death of friends and family members and the ending of relationships, but also because I realized I'm not very good at grieving. So I had a relationship in my 20s that took me 4 or 5 years to grieve. And I realized later on when I was doing that letter writing process, I still hadn't fully grieved it. And just getting stuck in those emotions and not able to move forward, I feel really like set my life back in a way that slowed me down. But also I was speaking with a counselor sort of five years ago who asked me, have you grieved your parents' divorce? And I said to her, that's not mine to grieve. It never occurred to me that I lost something in that process, that I lost the expectations of what my teenage years would be like, the expectations of what it would mean to have a father around more often and a mother that wasn't grieving so intensely for so long. And it never occurred to me. And it's still something I am slowly learning how to grieve. I'm actively trying to bring up some of that loss and process it, but it's not readily near the surface. But I bet you that the reason it took me 4 years to grieve that relationship in my 20s had a lot to do with that grief that hadn't been dealt with from my childhood and teenage years.
I'm sure, yeah.
I suppose I want to get better at grieving, but also acknowledging that grieving is a really natural, fundamental part of life, of human life and in society. We just don't talk about it enough. We don't give it enough space. We don't recognize that it isn't just crying and wailing. It is anger, it is fear, it is a desire to organize things and to do stuff. And there's all different ways to grieve and they're all valid. But grieving is so individual to a person. It is your grief. It looks like no one else's grief. And again, we come back to the point about empowering you to follow your own instincts and insights about you and your grief process, and feeling empowered to recognize you as the expert of your grief. But not to feel overwhelmed by it, but to feel it as our friend Neville said to me when I spoke to him the other day, he said, I want to be able to welcome grief as a friend.
And I know Neville from men's work type circles. We both did a men's rites of passage together. And within that world, common language within that space and community is grief work. We talk about men needing to do their grief work. And apart from the fact, I think it's beautiful that it's common parlance within that group. I think the word work is also relevant because it is work. It's not just like, as you say, you get a bit emotional and you're going to cry. Like, you don't know what it looks like and you don't know where it will lead you writing for 3 weeks, you know, to process through stuff. Yeah.
And you never know where, not that when it'll sneak up on you. I find it hard to even recognize that I am grieving, you know, and that's not done yet. You know, as someone who wants to move through emotions as quickly as possible and to get them out of the way because they're a hassle.
Yeah.
Grief continually returns to you until you fully accept that loss as part of your new reality. But like with the ending of a relationship, you have to grieve the loss of that person physically being in your life, the emotional support they gave you, the shared interests you had together, the plans you had for the future, the expectations, and all of those are all their own individual griefs. You know, you're not just grieving the relationship. You have to go through all the bits and pieces and grieve them one by one. And that takes time. That is difficult. It takes patience.
Yeah. We probably should wind up soon, but I want to ask you a question, and I'm sure you've thought about this. From a Myers-Briggs perspective and looking at grief, have you seen introverted feeling and extroverted feeling and their roles within grief? Because, again, feeling functions, we all have one. We might have a first, we might have a second, we might have a third or fourth. But we all have either introverted feeling where it's more about the feelings within us, or extroverted feeling, it's more about the feelings out there that are outside of us.
I think one of the interesting things is here, almost look more at either temperaments or those two middle letters coming together in the middle.
Yep.
Rather than just the feeling function. So intuitive feelers or NFs are generally more comfortable with feelings anyway. Feelings aren't so foreign. They don't feel so overwhelming. They might come as complex emotions. They might come with, you know, maybe a lot of guilt or a lot of other things coming together. But they're less likely to push them away so thoroughly in the way an intuitive thinker might. Because intuitive thinkers are far less comfortable with emotions, regardless of what, you know, combination of type they are. And I think that's been one of the hardest things for me. Like, I've spent a lot of years focusing on my physical health, and I'm getting far more comfortable reading the signals of that. But emotions hit me flat every single time they show up. Whilst I'm learning a language for them, I'm learning how to process, they're never easy. They are always challenging. They knock me flat every time, and I'm having to learn some really basic self-soothing or other techniques to really know how to be in that emotional space.
Because, see, the other layer I would add to that is that the NF types are the ones of us that are NF that have extroverted feeling. I do agree, and that's me, are more comfortable with emotions generally, but mostly it's other people's emotions. Like, I'm much more comfortable with other people's emotions than my own. Actually, I've never quite put it that way, but I am. I'm more comfortable with others' emotions than my own. And I think that for the NF types that have introverted feeling, they're more comfortable and more at home with their own emotions. I don't want to put words into their mouth than they are with others' emotions, but that would be my guess.
Yeah, no, I'd agree, definitely.
But what you're saying is both of those categories are more comfortable with emotions than the, for example, the NTs or even the STs.
Well, it's a skill set. Think of every element as a skill set. So feelers have spent their lives, and they may not have feeling fully developed, but they've spent their life seeing the world through emotions in some form.
It's an emotion lens.
And thinkers have spent their lives looking through the world in a logic lens. And so when you hit with something like grief, which is complicated and large, regardless of what the loss is, doesn't matter what you've lost, whether it's a job or a person. When grief hits us, it tells us that something has been fundamentally important to our identity, to who we are, to our life structure. And that is not a simple, easy feeling to navigate, no matter what. But if you've already got some form of skill set in it, it's going to be a little bit easier in some ways to start to navigate. Now, that said, that doesn't mean you're going to deal with it immediately. You might put it off for a while. but I think there is a recognition that there's more awareness.
Mm. I look at it like the software is there, ready to be used. So, like, I didn't grow up in a family that taught me emotional intelligence, and I can observe in my teenage years largely doing emotions from a introverted intuition, introverted thinking way. So it was all in my head.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking for the patterns and I was analyzing them logically. So I had a very poor foundation. But what I think gave me a step up, I suppose, is when I went there, I had hardware there, or I had software. Well, I'd think of it more as hardware. I had hardware there ready to be used. You know, I had an extroverted feeling there ready to. And I think you're right. I was still always seeing the world through that lens to a degree. It's a fascinating topic.
Yeah. So one of the people I'll be speaking to as part of the course I'm putting together has done some research on the way different personality types grieve by looking at the four middle letters, sensing, intuitive, thinking, and feeling.
Yeah.
And looking at different ways to grieve to meet that part of the personality. So to grieve in a sensor form, you might do some gardening, you might organize a funeral. There are very physical aspects to it. In the intuiting side, you're looking for meaning. You're looking to make sense of why this has happened. And there are different rituals and things you can do around that to help you with that process.
So like I did earlier when I was talking about the story that I've applied to my health issues, and I've applied this story which says, I'm going to monetize this. I'm going to use this to change the world. I'm going to make this pain and suffering of value. And it's been part of the process of the grief, you know, because there is, like, that's almost like second to the grief. You know, it's like I've lost time. I've lost all sorts of things. I've lost. How can I now redeem that with a meaning-making thing?
Mm.
Very, very interesting. It's just something I was thinking about then, you know.
Yeah.
Us intuitives like to add that meaning piece. I mean, we all do, I think.
So feeling is grieving at, you know, the emotions, and thinking is looking for logic.
Mm.
And she's got a lot more examples, which we'll go through in the course. But what she was saying, which I found really interesting, is that people get stuck. So imagine you need to go through all four of those in an order of your stack. Let's just say that to make it easy. And you need to do all four to fully grieve whatever the issue is. But people get stuck on either their dominant function and or their secondary. That means they can't then complete that full process. So as an intuitive, if you can't find meaning for something, if you can't figure out the why, then you're never going to get to the feelings and the logic and the sensory stuff. I've been able to figure out the meaning of some things, but with this relationship that I've been grieving, I've been stuck on the logic. I've been stuck on, this just doesn't make sense. I can't understand why this happened, and not being able to really define that. And that has pushed back and slowed down me fully accessing the grief of the feelings and the sensory process to complete that grieving. And so I'm really looking forward to talking to her and understanding that in more detail from the research she's found, because she's done some actually surveying around people and their personality types and their preferred way of grieving. It's not as comprehensive research as we might like, but there's some really interesting things to come out of that.
Mm, that's fascinating. Would she want to come on a podcast?
Oh, possibly. She loves talking about it.
So before we wind up, is there anything else that you wanted to say or share? And you can, of course, come back again. So there's no...
Well, that's good.
Well, I mean, as long as I don't get abuse for having you on here.
That's the best kind. You get more people paying attention when you get...
That's true. I haven't had any hate mail yet, so there's still time.
I think I would just say that when it comes to our health, that it can help to just expand our understanding and recognize that we know a lot more than we get ourselves credit for, even if we don't know that right now.
Mm.
That if we just look at something from a different angle and think, okay, how am I thinking about this? How am I feeling about this? What are my physical actions, or what meaning am I attributing to this? We can start to shift into just a different perspective, and that different perspective can lead you into a new place around how to progress your healing in some form.
Mm. That's great. Love it. Well, thanks for coming on. This has been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to releasing this. And it's been a bit of a different topic, which I love. I love, you know, the convergence. That's the podcast, you know, convergently thinking. I see so much interrelationship between things. And so getting people that have skills and knowledge in specific areas and seeing how all those narratives interweave through the different episodes is really, really cool. Best of luck with everything that you're working on, and
thank you.
Let us know when it launches and we can get you back on to talk further.
Absolutely, we'll do.